You're listening to the All Over Cricket Podcast. Welcome to the season premiere of Season 2. I'm Jay Donsinghani, and today we'll be previewing Group A of the Men's T20 World Cup with freelance writer Bertus de Jong, who writes about cricket for CricBuzz and is an editor at TK Cricket. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at All Over Cric and catch Bertus on there at BDJ Cricket. Anyway, 2 days to the World Cup. Here's your Group A preview. Bertus, welcome to the AOC podcast.
Thanks, Jay. Great to be back on the pod.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And we were just talking about this off camera as well, or off mic. You know, it's hard to believe it's been 2 years since we roomed together at the T20 World Cup qualifiers. Almost 2 years to the day, in fact.
Yeah, two days, 10th of October, I think, we all rocked up there. So that's almost exactly 2 days ago.
Yeah, and that's also the last time the Dutch team were together as a full-strength squad.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of teams, of course, have struggled to play much cricket during the pandemic, but the Dutch generally struggle to play cricket as a full-strength team anyway. So the team that's reconvened, as it turned out, in the United Arab Emirates, hasn't played together at full strength since that tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually spoke to Ryan Campbell yesterday, and the podcast is coming out later this week. And, you know, they've been in the UAE since the 22nd of September. And, you know, Ryan told me this, and I was like, wait, why? Like, why would you do that? You only have to quarantine, I believe, for like 6 days or something upon arrival. And he was like, there just aren't enough turf facilities available in September, October in the Netherlands. So we thought we'd come here a little early. And, you know, facilities are pretty good. They're up at the, I believe, the 7 stadium right now. But, you know, there's that. But there's also just been a lack of warm-up games so far. They're only playing their first warm-up game today, I believe. It might be against Scotland. I got to check that again. But
yeah, that's right. It's the official unofficial game, but the one that's organized by the ICC as part of the official lead-up to the tournament. And yeah, it's Scotland, and then they've got Oman in a couple of days' time.
I think that's a good place to start, actually, you know, since we've segued onto that. Just talk to us a little bit more about the Netherlands since November 2019.
So, as I say, with a lot of teams, that COVID has been a pretty significant issue. As an associate, they don't really have the funding and the resources to run bio bubbles and the like. So they've struggled for matches. The last T20Is they played were the Tri-Series in Nepal back in April. That was very much with what looked like a development Dutch team, with very few of the county guys coming over. Since then, of course, they've had ODI cricket as their priority, with those crucial Ireland games coming for the Super League. So in terms of T20I prep, it's really just been what they've been able to play at home in the Netherlands, which of course doesn't feature much of the middle order or the frontline pace building attack. So in terms of team prep, they've had very little other than what they're doing now in the direct lead up to the tournament. And unlike, as I'm sure listeners will have noticed, a lot of the other qualifying teams have been engaged in a pretty extensive schedule of warm-up matches, most of which are actually official T20Is. And in fact, the UAE managed to sell those as a package and as a tournament. They managed to sell the rights for those. So those have... the other teams featuring, so Scotland, PNG, Namibia, Ireland, and the UAE themselves, they've had a pretty serious run of games ahead of this tournament, whereas the Dutch, in what I'm not convinced was actually their first choice prep, have been mostly playing internally amongst themselves. And I think there were some attempts to rope in some of the other players from sides that are from Super 12 sides that happened to be in Dubai for one reason or another. But that fell through owing to complications of quarantine bubbles and the like. So it's been what I can only assume to have been a fairly extended net session for the Dutch ahead of their first game against Scotland, which, as we record, I guess is starting in about just a few hours' time.
Yeah, I think around 7 hours' time, assuming they're playing the night game and not the day game.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I think you're right there. So I'm losing track with time zones and that.
you and me both, brother. It's no, honestly, though, it's been quite frustrating, you know, for anyone who's in the Netherlands camp or any Netherlands fan, because you look at your last home summer in 2020. I believe you were supposed to play England and you were supposed to play Pakistan. And once again, because of the pandemic and all the uncertainty around travel and then, you know, the pre-vaccinated COVID era, the entire home summer got scrapped, you know. So it's been a lack of match practice in the build-up to the World Cup, but we're also talking about just a lack of game time, period, across formats, right? You had the Tri-Series, you had the Ireland Series, a couple of games against Scotland, but that's really about it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been pretty barren for the Dutch, in spite of the ODI League fixtures that are still on the calendar. So first, the West Indies series was postponed. I think even before COVID, that was pushed back. And then, yeah, much like, again, like a lot of sides, and Scotland lost a few huge games that probably won't be coming back for them. But yeah, for the Dutch, it's frustrating, of course, though I'm not sure that the KNCB will be unduly upset by it, because at the end of the game, the ODI League games will still happen. And simply from a logistical point of view, it's easier for the KNCB to put those, to run those close together rather than spaced out, given the amount of sort of attention that has to be paid to facilities and build up ahead of those. There aren't any full-blown cricket stadiums in the Netherlands, so the grounds have to be converted with temporary stands and the like. So there's a lot of cost issues involved there. And you notice that the West Indies tour that's just been announced is, I think there's less than a week between that and the England series. And that will have been done for cost reasons as much as anything else. So cramming the entire remainder of the home ODI league fixtures into one summer, I think potentially works in the KNCB's favour, as it also means that the team will then have a chance to gel in a way that it hasn't in the lead up to this tournament. And while for all countries, of course, World Cups are huge, especially for associate countries who rarely get to play on a stage as big as this, from a purely sort of hard-nosed commercial standpoint, the ODI League is what guarantees the fixtures going forward. So while there's prize money on the line at the World Cup, there isn't a sort of this sinecure that you get if you finish high enough in the ODI League. Though this time around, the exception to that, of course, is that if you made the Super 12s, you are guaranteed at least one more World Cup. So that perhaps puts a different spin on things than usual. But as a general rule, World Cups are seen as a reward rather than a means to an end. So that the ODI focus, I think, is entirely understandable in that respect.
No, absolutely. You raise a great point. And it's something, you know, I think everyone should be reminded of, you know, in case you've forgotten. You get through to the Super 12s, you get into the next World Cup. And, you know, in the interview that I had with Ryan, a big thing, something he was pretty adamant about, is he does not want to go to the global qualifier. It's, you know, it's going to be pretty cutthroat. You have all the teams that are going to be missing out on the Super 12s this time. And then, you know, you have teams like the UAE, who look stronger, Nepal, who, despite the retirement of Paris Khatka, they're actually looking quite good, right? I'd argue they're a better team than they were in July 2019 when Singapore, you know, got in to the qualifiers ahead of them. So, you know, you have teams like that, you know, perhaps the USA getting in. I think Hong Kong just got in today.
Well, I think you're forgetting a big one, and that is, of course, Zimbabwe will be back next time around. And what's more, it won't be a global qualifier in the way that we so enjoyed in 2019. because the global qualifier has at least for this cycle been split into two competitions, two probably 18 competitions, which, as you say, could potentially be absolutely cutthroat. Might have several full members in those. But I think that's probably a topic for another podcast if we're looking forward to qualification for the next World Cup. Although I'm very aware that I'm currently in Spain specifically because there's a sub-regional qualifier, the European qualifier, that's here in a couple of weeks' time. But yeah, I think maybe a subject for another pod before we get ahead of ourselves. We've got a World Cup in front of us.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, you know, we've talked about what's potentially holding the Dutch back, but you know, let's talk about some of the positives. You know, after all, they are considered to be one of the favorites to go through, along with Sri Lanka. I'm not sure Irish fans are going to like the sound of that, but you know, certainly the Dutch would be really disappointed if they didn't get through to the Super 12s. So, you know, just walk us through, you know, some of the positives for the Dutch and, you know, what we can look forward to in the tournament.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably a fair assessment. And I think Irish fans will forgive us because the mood in Ireland, from what I understand, is what you might describe as cautiously pessimistic. But yeah, the Dutch, on paper, you would make them favourites along with Sri Lanka to get through this group. They qualified in top position. They're not seeded in top position now because they redid the entire seeding on rankings for some reason. They won the qualifier and won it fairly comfortably. And let's not forget the qualifier was also in the Emirates. Now the grounds in the Emirates, from what we've seen in the IPL, aren't necessarily playing the same, especially Abu Dhabi and Sharjah, where the Dutch barely played in the qualifier, but they've got all three of their first round games here at those two grounds now. But they are full strength. They have, as we know, an incredibly strong pace attack, strong and varied pace attack. The middle order is vastly experienced, and you know, with the return of Dennis Schater and now Colin Ackerman coming into the side and Roelof van der Merwe, and then you know, and with a potentially very dangerous top order as well in Myberg if he fires and O'Dowd and Cooper at the top, in the top three. In principle, this is an extremely strong Dutch side. I think it's actually as strong, if not the strongest Dutch side that I've seen the Netherlands put out. So yeah, you would make them favourites along with Sri Lanka to go through this group. But the nature of the group is such, and I think that's something we probably ought to talk about, that it is, for want of a better word, a bit of a crapshoot. You've only got three games in principle with a four-team group and three games. Even though there are two teams going through from each group now, you can win two, lose one, and go out on net run rate. That's not just, you know, arithmetically possible. That's, I think, a scenario that's likely to happen in one or other of the groups, or at least as likely as not. It's an absolutely vicious format, and I think this is something that Sri Lanka probably ought to be concerned about as well, even though they probably are still marginally the strongest team in the group. It's not by a lot, and they only need to lose one to be at risk of not progressing. And that's the nature of the format that they've done with this absurd requalifying round, that I don't think is really fit for sorting the strongest teams. I think Sri Lanka might have preferred, if you look at simply their chances of getting through, to have had an expanded global qualifier, which, as we both agreed, we were there, has an excellent format, and where the strongest teams have a far better chance of coming back from early upsets or the like. The fact is that these tiny groups, as we've seen in the past, lead to net run rate being a huge factor, and really there not being any leeway to set a single foot wrong.
Yeah, no, you raise a great point. You lose one game, you could have a pretty decent tournament and still not make it through. And I mean, once again, you know, this is probably a topic for another podcast, but you know, you could make the argument, you know, I would make the argument that you just shouldn't have this first round. you know, it should just, you should just have an expanded World Cup. And, you know, it, in a way, this just feels like a glorified qualifier. And
This is it. I mean, we're a bit of a broken record on expanded World Cups, and both World Cups are expanding going forward. So perhaps we shouldn't complain so much. But I would go further than that. I'd make the point that even if you just have accept that this is a 12-team World Cup, I think it would be far fairer on both the qualifying teams that have come through the global qualifier and on the two teams that have missed out by the rankings in Sri Lanka and Bangladesh. If the final places in the Super 12 were decided at a proper qualified tournament rather than in this sort of tacked on nonsense at the start of the World Cup, where there's absolutely no guarantee that the best teams will get through. But yeah, you're right. I mean, this is format chat now and very much probably something for another podcast if we want to deal with it in any kind of depth. But it is, of course, relevant to these teams when we're trying to talk about predictions for this first round, is to acknowledge that like the best teams will not necessarily win. The best teams won't necessarily get through. So we can talk about strengths and weaknesses, and we can talk about the potential matchups. But when it comes to predictions, I mean, you it really is a bit of a guessing game.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I want to come back to something you said a few minutes ago about the Netherlands pace attack. And, you know, one thing that really impressed me in 2019 was their team balance. You know, you have Colin Ackerman, skipper Peter Celaar, and of course, Roelof van der Merwe. And all of these, you know, all of these spinners are genuine all-rounders, you know, who can get in, at least with two of them, at least with Ackerman and van der Merwe, they can get in just as batters, you know. So when you have three spinners who can bat, you know, it gives you that freedom to pick four fast bowlers, which is, and I believe the Dutch were the only team to do this throughout the tournament, maybe Ireland on one or two occasions. The Dutch were the only team to actually pick four fast bowlers throughout the tournament. But, you know, just moving things along to, you know, the other teams, you know, let's talk a little bit about Sri Lanka now. So a big question, I guess the big elephant in the room is, will Sri Lanka get knocked out before the Super 12 stage, and what do they have to watch out for?
Well, I think I've laid the groundwork there, and the answer is a resounding maybe.
There's nothing resounding about that verdict, man.
It is a colossal maybe. It's a maybe written in 20-foot-high neon letters flashing outside your bedroom window in the middle of the night. It is a colossal maybe. Sri Lanka are not anywhere close to guaranteed to get through this group. It's an extremely tough group. I've said before, and I maintain that the groups are horribly lopsided. Sri Lanka could lose to any of these three teams. They've been lumped, firstly, of course, with the other four member, although that's probably not their greatest concern. They've had a woeful record of last year in the shorter format. I think they've only won maybe three or four of their last 20 official T20Is. Now, of course, that is exclusively against higher rated four member opposition and indeed stronger teams than they'll be facing here, but not significantly stronger in some cases. And I think if they, the big question is, I think there was some play, of course, in the media about some ill-advised stuff that went up on the Sri Lanka website, rubbishing the competition. But I don't imagine, actually, that the Sri Lanka camp will be underestimating the challenge. At least you would hope not. But the fact is that it's very rare that when you have two professional T20 teams that one of them is a significant favourite over the other. And I think that while I would put Sri Lanka at better than evens to win all three of their games. So I'd be very surprised if they didn't drop at least one. These are three very dangerous sides. First up, they're going up against Namibia, a side who they won't know a great deal about, who go hard from ball one and bat deep down the order. Sri Lanka, I think you've got, you know, you saw them play two unofficial T20Is against Oman, which they both won fairly handily in the end, but certainly not without being made to sweat at times. And they have in Kusha Pereira, if he's fit, and I think there's still some question marks about that, Hasaranga and Shamira, three players that any team in this group, and I think most teams in this tournament, would be very glad to have in their dressing room and on the field for them. But I don't think there's any guarantee that's going to be enough to see them through this group. I would put them at better than evens, but I certainly wouldn't go much further than that.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with you. And I guess this comes back to the whole, you could win two out of three and still get knocked out. And it certainly is a possibility with Sri Lanka. And, you know, this is going to sound weird, but I feel like one thing that could be working in Sri Lanka's favor is the fact that their selection has just been all over the place in the last 2 years. And then you had those suspensions for COVID bubble breaches in England. And it just seems like with every Sri Lankan squad that is chosen, you have five or six completely new names, or names being pulled in from the wilderness, being recalled after 2, 3, 4 years. And it just seems like every Sri Lankan squad, you have five or six different names. Every 11 that comes out, you could have five changes to the 11. And in a strange way, this might actually work in Sri Lanka's favor, you know. And you know, Ryan Campbell spoke about this as well. He said it's kind of hard to, you know, we've been out, his assistant coach, Andrew Hilditch, has been working overtime, you know, just trying to figure out who's going to play, you know, what do they do, who bowls when. And
yeah, I guess. Well, Jimmy's got a bit of a disadvantage compared to, as you say, because when you have, normally when you have a matchup between, certainly in the past, between associates and full members, is that the one advantage that associates have is that they will know their opposition a lot better than their opposition will know them. So normally when, you know, you have these one-off ODIs and one-off T20s, then you've got, firstly, the players themselves will know the opposition better because they've seen them play. And you've got a wealth of video material for analysts like Jimmy Hilditch to look at, whereas the opposition don't. And I think on both sides, that advantage is narrowed insofar as that, of course, that there's a lot more associates cricket on television and a lot more associates cricketers playing their cricket in full member countries, certainly in the case of the Dutch, who have a lot of guys in the county system. So that sort of unknown factor, that mystery factor that associates have, has been kind of eroded. Whereas in the case of this Sri Lanka side, I think you're right in that they do have that sort of unknown quantity, which will be arguably harder to plan for their opposition. So yeah, you might be, I think that's a fair point. I think that does play in their favour to an extent, although probably not in their first game, comparatively at least, because I don't imagine that Sri Lanka will know very much about this Namibia side, though there is probably a little bit of video available. The players themselves, I don't think will know too much about Namibia going in. And Namibia are, I think, one of the three sides that Sri Lanka will face, arguably the most dangerous in terms of being able to take a game away quickly. I don't think they're all around the strongest of the three challengers. I think, as I said, that the Dutch probably have them there, but probably certainly in terms of the batting, they are the most dangerous.
Yeah, it's a good point you raised there. And at least from my perspective, I get the impression with Namibia, yes, their batting definitely is their stronger suit. But the addition of David Visa, you know, you have a genuine all-rounder in David Visa, a proven performer, you know, in global T20 leagues. And perhaps that's not quite enough to, you know, round off their bowling lineup. And, you know, just on the topic of their bowling lineup, I find it quite interesting. You know, if any team is, you know, I feel like most teams have to watch out for that left arm matchup. And Namibia have potentially three left armers who could be making that first 11. You know, JJ Smith's definitely going to play. There's been a lot of buzz around Ruben Trompelman, who, you know, he's been doing really well recently. And of course, there's a Jan Freilink as well. So you could potentially see three left armers in their starting 11, at least two, I would assume. So, you know, do you think that's going to be much of a thing to watch out for? Is that something, you know, some like an underrated aspect of Namibia's threat in this tournament, that left arm angle?
Well, I think you're right there. They have those three left armers, and they're much like the Dutch pace attack. They have this advantage of variety now, especially now the visa's in, so that it isn't straight up left armers all the way through, but they are different left armers. Trumperman does give you an extra yard of pace. He's close to what you might call an out and out quick. JJ, of course, doesn't bowl express, but he hits that back of the length, you know, can cramp up batsmen, and Jan Freilich's accuracy. And he can, if the ball is swinging, I think gives you another dimension as well. So it's not an entirely one dimensional pace attack, but the addition of Visa, not only because it gives you the right arm option, but also because of his experience and his ability, his variations, especially I think at the death, I think he gives them something that they were missing. I'm not convinced that Visa will be the standout player for Namibia at this tournament, but I do think that he adds an enormous amount to the side, both with the bat and the ball. He adds something that I think that Namibia were missing. I still think that the bowling may turn out to be their weakest suit. You do have, you know, a left arm orthodox spinner in Bernard Schultz, who's now very experienced and has had enormous success at associates level, and Nicole Lofty-Eaton coming into the side, who I think is one of the most exciting young players that we're going to see at this tournament. He's looked very dangerous with the bat. He has that kind of that quick rushing leg spin that has seen Rashid Khan become a global star. And I think that while the bowling still isn't their strength, Visa does lend it a degree of balance. I think that if Namibia are going to come unstuck in this tournament, then one of two things will be the issue. One is that they have a couple of the bowlers. They will end up with some overs that, for quality players, will be fairly hittable. And the batting themselves, while it is extremely dangerous, is always still a bit death or glory. They do have this depth because you have the likes of JJ and now Visa coming in down the order, that they can turn a middling start into a challenging score. Whether they have the quality to get two wins out of three, or the three you need to guarantee your way through is an open question. Whether they have that consistency against top quality opposition, I don't know, but they're certainly capable of it. And they do have the advantage that of the four teams in the group, they're the only ones really coming into this group with any kind of momentum and form. And their form has been excellent. I mean, mostly it has been at home in rather different conditions than what we'd expect to face at Abu Dhabi and later Sharjah. But of the three, of the four teams in this group, Namibia are the only ones that are currently used to winning.
Yeah, no, you make a good point. And, you know, just going off that, they defeated the Titans, you know, who had a whole host of South African internationals, some of whom have been capped pretty recently. I can't remember the scoreline in the series. It could have been 3-1. Don't quote
me. I think it was, yeah. They didn't lose many games at home over that summer. And they had South Africa emerging over as well for an extended series. And they had, admittedly, not the strongest Zimbabwe development side. But the fact is they were rotating players in and out, and everyone's constantly performing. There's barely a player in that side that hasn't got runs or wickets under the belt. I think they barely lost. I think they lost maybe three, four games in that whole summer, and they played an awful lot of games. I just looking at their form going in, and again in the warm-ups, Craig Williams is now coming into form as well. That he's one of the less talked about guys in that batting lineup, but he's been hitting the ball hard and far. Which I think, given that, you know, with the retirement of JP Kurtzer, Williams coming into form now as well, suddenly makes their batting look almost as strong as it did, maybe say like over the summer or at Division Two, and you remember that game against Hong Kong, probably not fondly.
God, you just had.
Yeah, you'd say. Yeah, if it weren't for the form that they're in, it's fashionable, I guess, to tip Namibia as dark horses to go through. But I don't think there's anything particularly dark about it. I think that they've got every chance of getting through, and I think they'll back themselves to get through this group. I think they have some well placed confidence. This is the strongest team. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that this is the strongest Namibia team that they've ever put out.
Yeah, you make a good point, and. You know, just moving things along. Let's and I guess this actually relates a little bit to Namibia. The conditions and specifically the venues for the first I hope I'm doing my math right here. The first four games, yeah. So the venue for the first four games are gonna be played in Abu Dhabi. And you know, one concern I have about Namibia, if I'm not mistaken, they played all, if not most of their games at the qualifier in Dubai. And I just get a feeling with their batting lineup, perhaps those larger grounds in Abu Dhabi, it may not allow someone like a Gerard Erasmus to, you know, slog four sixes on the leg side like he did against Singapore's Siddhant Singh. You know, that's going to be a little harder to do in Abu Dhabi. And, you know, once again, you know, you factor in Namibia's bowling lineup as well. Of course, you've got Bernard Schultz, who's been around forever, right? But just in the spin department compared to, you know, certainly compared to the Netherlands, maybe even Ireland with, you know, Simi Singh and Ben White. And then, of course, you have the Netherlands with their spin bowlers, you know, Ackerman, Szilar, Van der Merwe, correct my pronunciation.
If I'm remembering right, I don't have the schedule in front of me, but I think they play Ireland at Sharjah. Namibia play Ireland at Sharjah in their last game. So it'll be Sri Lanka and the Dutch that they're playing in Abu Dhabi. I think you're right. I don't imagine that the conditions will suit them quite to the extent. And you're right, they were in the Dubai group for the qualifiers, so they would have played most of their games. At the Academy or at Dubai International. I think you're right. I think that they're aware of that going in, that conditions will not suit them as well as they would, say, at home. But I don't think that's something that they will... I think that's a reason to write their chances... I don't think that's a reason to write their chances off. We've seen them looking strong on pitches that are harder to score on in the past. We've seen them in the lead up to the tournament in their warm up games, rather, looking quite capable of adjusting to the grounds in the UAE. And what Abu Dhabi looks like is, by the time that the qualifier rolls around, first round rolls around, is of course something of an open question. We've had the benefit of an IPL. To watch in the run-up to the tournament, so we've obviously got some idea, and it does look slow, hard to score on, but I haven't really seen, apart from perhaps yesterday's game at Sharjah, but I haven't really seen that the paces are out of the game, or even that that we haven't seen really extravagant turn or the like for the spinners. So I'm not convinced that this will be a tournament entirely dominated by spin. I think it will be tough to score as freely and as quickly as certainly teams like Namibia are used to on their own grounds these days, at least. Of course, going back a few years, grounds at Vintock weren't too dissimilar to what we've seen at Abu Dhabi in charge of the IPL. And Sharjah especially looks extremely slow. The outfield, as always, but now the square itself, the pitches at Sharjah have been playing rather more turgidly than we've been used to in the past. But then, yeah, Namibia. See, these three teams did come through qualifier at the UAE, and while the pitches I think were a little bit more batter friendly than what we'd expect, I'm not convinced that necessarily there's any one team that will benefit unduly from the conditions in this group, at least.
So moving things along, it's strange that we haven't covered Ireland yet. You know, perhaps that's a reflection of our subconscious opinion that, you know, they might not do too well in Group A. You know, I'm just going to come out and say it. I don't think Ireland is going to get through. You know, I'm not going to give them a 0% chance here, but I think that just so many pieces of the jigsaw that I haven't seen come together before this tournament, that they're just too many ifs and buts. I don't know, Bertus, am I being harsh here?
I think that generally most Irish cricket fans will forgive us if we say that Ireland are probably underdogs to get through this group. Which is admittedly a little odd, given that they are one of the two full members. But T20 has never been Ireland's strongest format. They only qualified in third place at this qualifier. And, yeah, as you say, they don't seem to have been able to really settle on a formula that works for them. And it's an open question as to why. Now, again, as you say, that is not to say that they can't get through this group. They could be any one of these teams if they play well. They could beat two of these teams. They could win all three games. They do have the talent to be capable of doing that. But it's not what we've seen from them recently. And it's not what we've seen, certainly, in the warm-up series against the UAE. It's not really, they didn't look hugely convincing at the qualifier either, although that was with a somewhat different side. And there are, at least, what is encouraging in Irish cricket is that you do see young players being given a run out. And I just feel like the transitional phase that, I guess, the post-golden generation transitional phase, which I think is a phrase that all Ireland fans will be absolutely sick of hearing, but that phase has lasted far longer in the T20 format than it has in 50 over, that they haven't really found a settled team or even a settled squad. And that while the promotion of Kevin O'Brien to open worked for a while fairly well, and in Paul Sterling and Kevin O'Brien, they do have a more than sound opening partnership. And Paul Sterling remains probably the standout bat. If you look at this group, he's absolute world class. Yeah. But the fact that the middle order just looks a bit of a mess at the moment, where it's not entirely clear which players are fitting into which roles, it puts an enormous amount of pressure on Sterling and O'Brien at the top. Which Sterling seems to have coped with in recent years rather better than O'Brien arguably has. There are those that think Kevin O'Brien might actually just be going into something of a terminal decline, which would be forgivable given the stage of his career. I'm not convinced that's the case. I think that the role he's being asked to perform for the team is weighing quite heavily on him as well. If you now have potentially the risk of, I'm not sure if we've had an update yet at time of recording on Andy Balbirnie's toe or toes, but he looked in a good deal of pain when he came off in that UAE game. If they do lose Balbirnie at number three, well, you'd think that Tector comes in as a fairly straightforward replacement, but I'm not sure you can replace Balbirnie's influence in that lineup as readily as you can replace his batting. And I think there's a deep question of just how it is that an Irish system that's produced quality cricketers in the 50 over format can't seem to do the same with T20, and why an Irish setup that's that supposedly shifting focus to the shorter format hasn't been able to find a, say, I don't want to say a brand of cricket, but a sort of a match winning formula that works consistently for them, even against, you know, associate opposition.
Well, to answer that concern, or, you know, to offer a potential solution, and I don't think this is something Ireland have pulled off as well as they could have. You know, you look at the likes of Neil Rock and Stephen Donnie, and, you know, on social media, I see this whole thing, you know, Neil Rock fails a couple times, and you see this whole thing like, hey, haters, what's up? Hey, Lorcan Tucker haters, where are you? And it's like, wait, hold on. Why are you campaigning so passionately for Lorcan Tucker to be reintegrated into the T20 setup? And for me, it's like, there's such a huge step up between, you know, the interpros and you know, the national team and international cricket. Trying to blood in these youngsters just, you know, a couple of months before a major world tournament, you cannot realistically, reasonably expect them to take to international cricket like moths to a flame. That's just not going to happen. And I personally just don't think that Ireland have given, you know, players such as...
I think you mean duck to water there, Jay, or perhaps you're right that moths to a flame is a better is a better analogy. But yeah, I do take your point. I think that Ireland, unlike a lot of their former associate peers, has two things which are some fairly vocal fans with opinions and a fairly lively cricket press, which is, of course, a good thing in principle, but it does lead to an awful lot of sort of last matchery where people have their favourite players, and if they perform, they want them. They're sort of crowing about it, and if their hated players don't perform, they're asking why they're not being dropped. But I think that the underlying question is making that step up from interpros to international cricket is, I think it is arguably more difficult in the T20 format. I think if you look at how the Wolves program has functioned, they don't seem, at least this is my impression, I haven't actually looked up the stats, so do correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like the Ireland Wolves plays less T20 than 50 overs. And I think that if you have a situation where you're regularly getting players that dominate or perform very well at interpro level, and then consistently these players that have solid records at home fail on the international level, then there is a problem with the way that your domestic setup is preparing players. And I think whether or not that's happened enough to call it a pattern is questionable. But what is noticeable is that the most successful introductions of the Irish team of late, in the form of Curtis Camfer, has been someone who hasn't learned his cricket in Ireland. And I think that when you have, you know, the sort of similarity of wickets that you have that these that kids grow up on playing in Ireland, the sort of bowling that they face, I think that is a genuine, I think, concern for Ireland going forward, is whether the production line that they have set up really works when it comes to supplying quality T20 players for the national side. I think that is not an unreasonable question to be asking at this stage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I guess, you know, let's talk about Ireland's fixtures as well. That very first game against the Netherlands on, I'm trying to do my math here, on Monday, next Monday.
Yeah, the 18th, I think.
The 18th, yep. So Ireland's very first game against the Netherlands, you know, it's going to be at Abu Dhabi. What do Ireland have to do to make sure that they win that game? Because if they don't win, you know, it's, once again, it's coming back to the tournament format. You lose your first game and, oh my word, like your tournament could be, you know, you've got one foot out the door at this point.
Yeah, it's out of your hands. You lose one game and the rest of the tournament's out of your hands. You just have to win two and then hope. It's hardly a blinding insight to say that it's a must-win game for both teams. As to what Ireland can do to ensure they win it, well, the answer is, well, they can't ensure they win it because they're not significantly better than the Dutch. Arguably, in T20 cricket, a full-strength Dutch side is genuinely stronger than what Ireland can put on the field. So Ireland have to play at their best and hope. But on the other hand, the Dutch look undercooked, or at least we say they look undercooked. We don't really know what they look like. You'd assume they'd be undercooked given that they've not played a game in some time. And Ireland, you know, there's no question that individually there's the talent in this Ireland side to beat the Dutch. They're not. It's not as if the Dutch have pulled away enormously in T20 cricket. I think just that the full strength Netherlands side, you'd expect them to win it on paper. That's not to say that they're a million miles ahead of where Ireland are, or that this game is a foregone conclusion. I think this game, if you wanted to put odds in it, I'd say 60-40 for the Netherlands going in. But it's so hard to call with this format. And having not seen the Netherlands playing in the lead up to it, it's a must win game for both teams. But then every single game in this tournament in this group stage is.
There's one thing we haven't spoken about with Ireland, the elephant in the room, and you know, with an eye on time, I guess we don't have too much time to delve into this, but. I mean, the elephant in the room, if Sterling gets out cheaply, Ireland's chances of winning, you know, plummet. I'm not sure if I'd say significantly, but it's, you know, noticeably, the chances of winning will be noticeably lower if Sterling gets out cheaply. But, you know, Bertus, it's been great to have you on just to round things off. You know, I'm going to put a gun to your head right now, mate. I want to know your predictions. You absolutely must choose. You've got to give me your top four right now, man. Come on.
Right. Well, I think I've thrown enough caveats in over the course of the podcast. I will warn you that you're not the first person to ask me for my predictions. I have been at imaginary gunpoint, given predictions for this group already, and I don't remember what they are. If you are an avid emerging cricket / American cricket podcast listener, you'll almost certainly call me out because I don't think I'm going to make the same prediction again because I can't remember what I said last time because I've got no idea what's going to happen. But I'm going to say that the your best bet is to say that you'd think Sri Lanka and the Netherlands will get through this group. That will scrape through this group. The only prediction I'm making that I'm confident on is that across one or other of the groups, someone's going out on net run rate and it'll be awful for them.
Okay. So, I mean, that was a little bit diplomatic. But, okay. Well, I mean, I should probably give you my predictions as well, you know, since I did.
Put your mouth where your money is.
See that's the thing about this group. Like, someone's gonna end up with egg on their face, you know. So I'm gonna go with Sri Lanka and the Netherlands to go through. I think, oh my god, man, I feel like I'm gonna get this horribly wrong, but okay. First place, Netherlands, Sri Lanka. I can't really choose between Namibia and Ireland. And with this group, I mean, for all you know, I might get, you know, I might have just like totally reversed the order, but I'm going to go with Sri Lanka and the Netherlands to go through. Ireland and Namibia, it's going to be close, but I think that they're going to miss out. So that's my prediction. And I think everyone's going to win a game. Everyone's going to win a game, at least.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to say you're wrong. I'm wildly unconfident in my own predictions for this group. I think the only thing that I could say is that anybody who is making confident predictions about this group hasn't been watching these teams.
Bertus, well, thank you so much for coming on the AOC podcast. Just to round things off, why don't you plug your social media channels so if people want to find you on Twitter or wherever, you know, they know where to go.
Well, yeah, I think most of my lengthy content you can probably find on my author page on QuickBuzz. If you would like to follow my musings on Twitter, you can find me at BDJCricket. That's about it. I do have a Facebook and an Instagram, but I don't think you're going to find anything of use on either of them.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Bertus.
Thank you for listening to the All Over Cricket podcast. You can follow Bertus on Twitter at BDJCricket and we're on Facebook and Twitter at All Over Cricket. Subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you're listening on and stay tuned for more World Cup content on All Over Cricket.